Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here. We are going to look this hour at the madness we're calling this presidential election. We're doing this Wednesday as well, after Super Tuesday, but we're going to hit some of the issues that have come up since the South Carolina primary, things that happened around and beyond that as well. The South Carolina Democratic primary, I should be specific. We are joined here today for this conversation by Bhaskar Sunkara, who is the, of course, founding editor of Jacobin and senior editor at In These Times. Bhaskar, good to have you back.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Catalina Byrd, media consultant, political strategist, person out here in WEAA. Good to have you back as well, Kat.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me.
And on the phone, Lenny McAllister, Republican strategist, former congressional candidate, host of Night Talk and Get Right with Lenny McAllister. Lenny, good to have you back. You there, Lenny? Okay, 410-319-8888. You can also join us here by writing to us, talk@signershow.org, by email. 410-319-8888 is the number. We'll come to these calls when you hear your thoughts on all of this. 410-319-8888. So let's just jump into this. I don't know where to begin. The South Carolina primary, for one, was an interesting primary, looking at what happened with Bhaskar, what happening with Sanders in that race. What it portends, I think, for the larger questions and the confusion of this presidential race. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think for certain there was a glimmer of hope in a lot of Sanders supporters like myself that he actually had a chance to really win the nomination. That was never the expectation going in. Of course, when he announced that he was running for president, he was polling somewhere between 1 and 3%. But after the big result in New Hampshire, after reaching close to parity in national polls, if he looks great in the head-to-head matchups with Republican candidates, I think a lot of people thought that he'd at the very least be able to close the gap and lose a bit more narrowly in South Carolina. So I think, for one, we have to acknowledge the fact that Sanders did manage to gain a lot of ground in South Carolina, and it sounds funny to say that given how big he got trounced by. But just a couple months ago, he was polling at 7% in the state. The other thing is he benefited in a place like New Hampshire from the fact that he wasn't the an establishment candidate. In a place like South Carolina, I don't think we should underestimate the extent to which people are deeply scared of the prospect of a Trump presidency. And beyond that, how much more people are familiar with Hillary Clinton. They might not be completely okay with all of her policies, but she knows, people know that she's a person that they're used to seeing on the national stage. She still has higher perceptions of electability. And I think all these kind of factored into the momentum that she's going to have, especially in southern states, where the fear of a Republican presidency for a very good reason is palpable. So we'll have to see what happens on Super Tuesday, but it's not looking great for the prospects of Sanders actually winning the presidency. I would say that I think he's going to be able to stick around until, if not the convention, very close to it, and that'll, I think, reshape the tone and tenor of this Democratic debate.
Lenny, are you with us?
I am.
Good, man. Well, you weren't there a moment ago. I was making sure you were there before I... How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. So you heard what Bhaskar said. So I'm curious your thoughts on South Carolina before we turn to Catalina Byrd.
I can't say I'm surprised. I mean, Hillary Clinton should have done that. I mean, honestly, with all the African Americans and the African American establishment behind her, she should have won the way she did. You know, the difference is people don't want to admit this, but just as much as they said, hey, Iowa and New Hampshire don't look like the diversity of America, neither did South Carolina in the Democratic primary. When you have almost 60% of the voters being African American, that's not symbolic of how America looks either. In a Democratic primary, yes. Specifically in the South, okay. But at some point in time, we're going to start seeing a fuller picture of what America looks like and how they're going to vote. And we're seeing the extremes of politics playing out in both parties. We're seeing the extreme anger and frustration playing out with the Republicans, and we're seeing the extremism in the case of diversity playing out in South Carolina. And that's the reason why you're seeing these very skewed results.
Catalina Byrd.
I agree to some extent with what Lenny's saying, but I also think that as the media, we've been complicit in the confusion of the Southern voters because all of them are not black. All of them are not Democrats. And the way that we frame this conversation around the two extremes, the Sanders and the Trump, I think is leaving a lot of people, and for whatever reason, we always see it, Democrats, if they don't like their candidates, will stay home. Republicans will vote and protest and vote for someone else. It's something strange, but it's always been the case. Republicans will not stay home and not vote. But if the Democrat doesn't like the options or feels like the person that they are in support of is a long shot and so hence a waste of their vote, they'll just stay home. And I think that we, and not us per se at WEAA or on the Steiner Show, but in the national context, in the mainstream media, painting this picture of it being an all uphill battle for Bernie Sanders, that it coming down to only the black vote for him, to having to champion his record on civil rights versus Hillary Clinton's, and keep reminding, or so we thought, reminding black voters that he, too, cares about them, even though they might know the Clinton name more. I think that we might have actually been complicit in that, whether we did so consciously or subconsciously. I have to be mindful of that going forward.
You know, one of the things that really strikes me about this election, this is for the Democrats for a moment, I'm going to jump right into Republicans and what is happening in the Republican Party and what it says about the future of America, which I want to get into, Bhaskar, while you're on the phone, because I know you have to leave us in about 25 minutes or so, and I'm going to keep you around as long as I can. So in this election, this is very telling. When you look at the Republican numbers in all these primaries so far have been way up, partially because I think of Trump, and we'll talk about that. But if you look at South Carolina, 532,000 Democrats voted in 2008. Only 367,000 showed up on Saturday. In Utah, 120,000 caucus members showed up in 2008. Only 80,000 Democratic, 30% drop in Nevada. New Hampshire, the turnout in 2008 was 288,000, almost 289,000 Democrats. In 2016, 250,000 Democrats, a drop of 13%. And in Iowa, 171,000 Democrats took part in the February 1st caucuses, 29% fewer than the 240,000 that showed up in 2008, Bhaskar. That says a great deal. And I was thinking about that in context of the election that put a conservative in the governor's house in Washington, in Maryland, in Governor Hogan. The same thing happened here. There was a dramatic drop in the Democratic turnout in four major counties. Many counties were full of communities of color, as well as progressive white Democrats who did not bother to vote. And so that, to me, signals something with the rise of this kind of Trump support that is exploding the Republican Party. What are your thoughts, Bhaskar?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for one thing, it's useful to push back against the narratives of voter apathy because it's not often that voters just don't care. It's just they're smart enough to realize that when the options on offer aren't very inspiring, when it seems like even when they elect people that they like, that they find inspiring, like Barack Obama, not much seems to change. You know, that all leads to people wanting to do other things with their limited time or being, you know, in this country, often being stuck at work and unable to get to the polls and not really feeling like it's worth the effort. And often they're responding quite rationally. I would say that it bodes very poorly for the Democrats in a general election, particularly if Hillary Clinton is nominated, partially because if she doesn't inspire enough enthusiasm, doesn't inspire the turnout, then it puts into jeopardy swing states. Whereas you could see this little bit more enthusiasm on the Republican side for their candidates. Partially that's because there's you know, a large field of them. But if there was this limited turnout, even to this point, when it seemed like there was a real contest between Sanders and Clinton, as Clinton pulls away in the next couple months, as you know, it looks like that's going to happen. The enthusiasm will just continue to wane. I think the one thing that could really save the Democrats is massive turnouts mobilizing kind of against a candidate like Donald Trump. And even that's kind of a turnout based on just the promise of lesser evilism, a defensive reaction, not kind of the soaring rhetoric of hope and the promises of different policies that to some extent Obama represented in 2008 and Sanders represented this election. So I think in a way the Democrats are really in trouble if it's kind of a Rubio Clinton matchup or something like that. I think they still might skate by this election cycle just because the fear of a Trump presidency will really motivate a lot of people, not just on the left of American politics, but in the center, to turn out to the polls.
Yeah, I think that that's probably very realistic, Catalina, what Bhaskar was just saying. I mean, I think it was almost a I've described it before on the air before, but I won't do it right this moment. It was just about what the Obama presidency meant for most Americans, which is why they voted for him. But that emotional internal surge doesn't seem to be here.
Well, it's not. And back in 2008, in 2009, that was my message. While other networks were adding black faces to their networks, I started the other show I used to have on Point specifically for millennials, because there was never going to be anything that felt as magical as that again. It wasn't going to feel that good for my generation or for anybody who was part of that moment that felt, that internalized it. It wasn't going to feel like that in 2012. And that was a place we had to be preparing for, and I think some were. I think I disagree with Foxwell to the extent that it's been my experience that actually the electorate is not that smart. And they have the attention span of net. And so they don't remember or make correlations between different cycles and midterms. And that's why we have the drop in turnout between the primary and general here in Maryland, because the apathy has been fed by Democrats. It's why you don't see the same turnout of certain generations and populations during midterms. So this was a moment we knew was coming. And I think that there were people and there were voices in the space that tried to continue to keep this in the right context, so we knew what to prepare for and what a Barack Obama-esque presidency looks like minus that energy. And that's Bernie Sanders. He's giving those ideas. He's saying where the next leg of the fight is now that we've got the Affordable Care Act and some other things. He's saying, this is how I carry on the baton. And because he's not black and he's not young, we're missing that he's talking about the continuation of what this Obama presidency actually has been, more so than Hillary Clinton.
So I think a lot of young people like Sanders, just because the fact that he is grandfatherly in some ways, I think that plays in his favor at some level. I mean, I think it's a complex question, but I think you're right on many levels, Kat. Lenny?
Well, there is an enthusiasm gap, and I think that it's interesting because the situation with Melissa Harris Perry kind of shows the dangers of what happens when you put all your hopes in one basket. That there's a reason why people, and not to be self-centered when I say this, but there's a reason why when people ask me, why would you stay involved in politics or stay involved with the Republican Party or get involved in civics, not just stay in media, there's a reason why I'm so intent on doing that, because if you only focus on being the moths to the flame, when the flame goes out, the moths will scatter. If you're going to bring critical attention and thus get necessary critical change implemented for the betterment of America and specifically those that are disadvantaged, you have to be able to access other aspects of the system and keep that enthusiasm high. And what you're seeing from the voters, I think you're seeing it from the Democrats in South Carolina, and even with the Republicans. I mean, there's a reason why a more mainstream Republican isn't beating Trump yet. It's because the enthusiasm gap is down for them as well. You know, Trump kind of masks that, because in a normal year, somebody like a Kasich or a Rubio or, dare I even say, Jeb Bush would have been able to take money, momentum, experience, or in Rubio's case, youth enthusiasm and inspiration to overcome Trump, regardless of the crazy stuff that he's been saying. But because the enthusiasm gap amongst one aspect of Republicans is down, the anger gap or the anger enthusiasm is able to overcome what we would normally see. On both sides of the aisle, I think the enthusiasm is down, and I think people are generally apathetic. They don't feel as inspired about what politics can be in America as we really need them to be. Because if you don't, you're going to get the government that you expect and you pay for.
So, but you know, but also, you know, one of the things happening here, picking up on that, Lenny Bhaskar, is that we're hitting things across the surface here. I want to come back to them in greater depth. But one of the things I've been thinking a great deal about in terms of what Lenny was saying in the Republican primary, looking at that, is the role of Trump and his supporters, before we get into the madness that's happening inside the Republican campaign itself, which is that, and I'm that the forces unleashed and have come around Donald Trump are some of the most deeply nativist voices in this country, racist, I'm going to add, desperate and fearful of where America's going. And I think that whatever happens in the Republican side of this two-way major battle between two establishment parties, that political force is not done after Trump. I don't know how it defines itself, but it has unleashed something the way that in some ways Black Lives Matter and the struggle against racism has released a force that's not going to be quieted. Do you know what I'm saying?
I would agree with you that Trump has awakened constituencies on the right that unfortunately are going to be around, pulling American politics in their direction or trying their best. But I'm not saying this just because I'm much more sympathetic to the politics of Sanders, but I do honestly think that if you look demographically at who Sanders is engaging, the base of young people, if you look at the workers that were supporting Sanders in early primary states and so on, I actually think that the Sanders supporters are demographically better positioned to influence American politics for the next 10, 20 plus years compared to the Trump supporters. And I would actually bet that the Sanders movement is less reliant on the personal charisma of a candidate, partially because Sanders doesn't quite have the personal charisma of other candidates. And not that I actually think Trump is very charismatic, but if you look at the polling, apparently people do. I obviously find him revolting. But, so I actually do think that they're better situated to create a new generation of Sanders Democrats in a coherent way that says, we're social Democrats, we're democratic socialists, we want to expand the welfare state, we want these programs, we don't like the DLC and people like Hillary Clinton. I think there's kind of a real coherence to the Sanders phenomenon that's not seen in the Trump one. And I actually do think that if there's one that has the potential to fade away quickly, it would be the angry people galvanized by Trump and not Sanders.
Now, that's possibly true, but I mean, I think that there is and I combine them sometimes and analytically, the Obama-Sanders effect, but more towards Obama, what's been unleashed here, and the studies showing that have come out recently showing how most people in their 20s and younger skew left and liberal, and both those descriptions. And you can see it that reality of that. So that there's a reason to think that could happen. But what I also could push back a little bit is that this force is, as someone put it on the show a few weeks back, I think it was Lawrence Brown, and he called it the fragile white vote. And what he meant, I think, by that, and what we talked about, was that people who are terrified about what their lives are like, where it's going, and also the changing nature of America. And I think that's been unleashed. I don't know what form it's going to take. It might not be about built around Trump, but it's going to be a force, I think, on some levels, somehow to contend with, that is connected in loose ways also to the surge of the Tea Party. And I think those things are hard to kind of disengage from one another.
That's what I'm going to say, Mark. We saw the surge and didn't know that Trump was going to be running for president. We saw the surge and we were saying, who are these people with the Tea Party? But I think that it fizzles out. I mean, part of what's fueling it is this fear of white people actually becoming the minority in what they believe to be their country. That's what the rhetoric was all about. And so while the Democrats have, I think they have a longer chance of revitalizing their party under the principles that Bernie's talking about. And it's even more so than democratic socialism. It's just humanism and common sense at this point. While the environment and other things are having real impacts on all of our lives, regardless of race, class, or culture. But on the Republican side, especially if Rubio becomes the nominee, I think you'll see them get frenzied one more time and then give up, because that is an opportunity for the Republicans to then get and keep for at least a number of generations the Hispanic vote in the way that the Democrats have gotten the black vote over the years. And they won't have, and so we'll see them get angry. We'll see them rail against both parties at that point if they are represented by people of color on both sides of the aisle. But it's because they're coming to an end of their power structure and their control as a majority. We know that there's still institutional practices that have to be changed. But I likened it on Facebook a couple of days ago to imagine being like a bald eagle as you all were going to go extinct. There is a psychosis that I think comes with that. And watching yourself go extinct. And essentially, the day that they, that angry mob that is a part of this American culture and forever defined what being non-white was by one drop was the day that they started the clock ticking on their own extinction. And that's starting to become very real for them. And I almost feel sorry for their craziness. I can't imagine.
Before we go back to Bhaskar, before he has to go, Lenny, you want to jump in here?
I think that the anger of the right isn't going to fade as fast as some may hope it would.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It drove the Tea Party. I mean, there and people don't understand about the Tea Party movement that it was this amalgamation of principled frustration, government spending, the economy going the wrong way, bailing out the people that threw the economy into the abyss. Again, they were mad at George W. Bush. He left office with a 29% approval rating, which means there were a lot of conservatives that were angry with George W. Bush. That was on the heels of the 2006 midterms where Republicans did stay home and the Democrats took over Congress. So you have the principled frustration coupled with the cultural anger. And when you combine that, too, with an economy that's still not on track, 4.9% unemployment rate and the lowest workforce participation rate since the late 1970s, you combine those two, and it's still an ugly picture. When you take that frustration, that anxiety isn't going anywhere until more people are working, until people are getting better educations, and until people feel safer about the world around them. And no one's really offered a solution for that, from President Obama to the Speaker of the House to the Majority Leader in the Senate, both Republicans and Democrats.
Bhaskar, I know you have to run shortly. Let me let you jump in here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think without a doubt, we shouldn't underestimate the threat that the right poses in this country. This kind of angry, far right or the type of people, that forms a segment of Trump's base. I wouldn't want to, paint everyone with the same brush there. But I do think that fundamentally, this represents a minority current in the United States, and the only thing that will actually guarantee that this minority current continues to grow and gain steam is if Democrats keep putting forward candidates whose very best a pitch for themselves is that they're not Republicans. The more Democrats put forward candidates like Bernie Sanders, candidates that agree or disagree with them, have their own agenda, are passionate about the things that a lot of ordinary people are passionate about, their livelihoods and their security and, the unemployment rate and, the state of our criminal justice system and so on. The more they put forward candidates with actually positive agendas, the more it undermines people like Trump. But if we're stuck with another, John Kerry-type nominees for the next couple decades, then you'll actually see anger and outrage be directed, solely, from the right. And I would say one more thing. I spent some time in New Hampshire a couple weeks ago before the primary. And what's striking is that Bernie Sanders doesn't just offer this kind of positive vision of what he wants and what he wants people to support him for. Things like universal health care and things like that. He actually offers enemies for people. He says to angry people, hey, we want these things, we should all fight to get them, but you know what, there's people standing in our way, and he calls it the billionaire class. He names families. He's talking about the Walton family. He's talking about Goldman Sachs. He's doing those things. And that's fundamentally similar to what Trump is doing, except Trump, when he's naming the enemies, is naming scapegoats, not enemies. He's naming, you know, immigrants. He's naming, you know, other people. So I think that if the left is to regain the initiative in this country, they need to kind of mirror what Bernie Sanders has done right, and they need to make sure that we're actually speaking to people's anger, but obviously taking this anger and not directing it at scapegoats, but at, you know, in such a way that actually builds a positive project that makes the country better for everyone.
One of the things, Bosco, before you run out, is you said, when you're talking about my initial question about the forces around Donald Trump and what may be being unleashed. There seems to be a real split, though. I noticed in one study I read, we talked about in the show here a couple of weeks back, that when you do the analysis of the elections of 2004, 2008, 2012, that Obama won by a 20 or 30 point margin of white working class voters who were union members. But by a greater margin, he lost white working class vote that were not union members. That to me was a significant vote, given a stat, given how unions are losing power and political power in this country, and other power as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think for one, people just don't feel connected to their unions. I mean, I myself was a union member for almost 3 years, and I was a member of a union that wasn't very good at engaging its membership. So it was a very passive relationship. You know, they took some money out of my check every payroll, and in return, I got decent drug benefits. You know, I would. It's an arrangement that kind of worked out for me, but it wasn't one where I felt some sort of vested interest or ownership in it. So I think a lot of the problem is really union membership isn't a very good indicator of politics when it comes to a lot of these unions, because these union members aren't actually politicized or trained by their unions. They don't actually feel an investment in the union. It's nothing more than kind of a very top-down relationship. So I think that's more telling of the actual, you know, condition of the labor movement, that it's not able to organize and engage more people around some coherent, you know, politics. In other countries, if you look at, you know, even Europe, even as far drifting to the center as some of these parties has gone, you know, organized labor has a real structural connection with left of center parties, and, you know, agree or disagree with it, has a real, really coherent program. So, you know, I do think that that there is possibility to organize people around their interests. We just need politicians that'll put forward proposals that you know, unite workers around a shared vision. Because, you know, fundamentally, the basics of politics, the basics of the Sanders campaign, is just to unite the many against the few. Unless the Democratic Party starts putting forward more politicians and more ideas like that, I just can't see how they'll continue to face up to right-wing populism like that of Donald Trump.
I know you have to run, Bhaskar. Bhaskar Sankara is the founding editor of Jacobin and senior editor in These Times. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yep. Thanks. Take care.
Appreciate it. Catalina Byrd will remain with us, as Lenny McAllister will. We're going to take a short break, come right back, and come right back to them and talk about some of the things that Trump has been saying and their other comments on this election and where they think the Republicans may be going in this election. I'm going to get your thoughts at 410-319-8888. On the way to the break, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or at SteinerShow.org is Maryland State Education Association's banner. We'll be right back with our guests. 410-319-8888. Join us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here. We continue our conversation about national politics this hour, as we will on Wednesday after Super Tuesday. We are here with Catalina Byrd, who is a media consultant, political strategist, and noted now on TV and radio here as well at WEAA. Linda McAllister is a Republican strategist, former congressional candidate, host of Night Talk, Get to the Point on Pittsburgh Cable News Channel, and Get Right with Linda McAllister on News Radio 1020 KDKA in Pittsburgh. And you all at 410-319-8888. You can also write to us here at talk@steinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner, but do call in. We'll get these calls right here, 410-319-8888. Let's go. Who's called in first was Tom. Tom, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, I'd like to comment about the local unions. They just don't promote their educated membership. They shut down their school for members to get master's degrees in labor relationships, the families of the upper management, they're on fabulous vacations taking the money of the local people, the local membership. And so you have this whole thing that goes on in the unions where they're no longer an educated organization. They're the big boss syndrome, and they affect the memberships to where the national unions have to come in and take over, investigate them, and take care of the irregularities that are going on. Thank you.
Tom, thanks. No, Tom, I think you raised that's the point, I think, Bhaskar was raising before we went to break, that unions are critically important in this country. They built what we have now in many ways for everything from the weekend to healthcare systems and more that working people have. But I think that part of it, Catalina, in some ways, and I know we are on different sides sometimes on the political spectrum, but I think that what's happened to a lot of, and this is not pro-Republican by any stretch, but what's happened to a lot of unions and in what's happened to a lot of central black organizations and politicians as well and others in this country is that in the 1970s and 80s, the Democratic Party kind of consumed all of that energy into its ranks, and rather than pushing for real change in America, it's been defending the establishment. The Republicans have that thing on their side as well, but I think that's part of the problem right now with exciting people to come out and vote and being part of this.
I would agree with you in that regard as to how they look similar and what happened, but also unions, they took two different turns, though, to end up in the same place. Unions kind of priced themselves out of the market and their relevancy, as the caller was saying. They offered things, and the previous guest had said, they offered things that encouraged and invoked engagement in a way that they don't anymore. And then you started to see the dues go up as they attempted to stay relevant in a political sphere, but the services they were giving to their members became increasingly less, and we're seeing that. Whereas the black institutions and the organizations that you mentioned that also got sucked up into that Democratic vacuum, there were issues of ego and individualism and not the continuation and sustainability of the organization that has in part created some of the vacuum we see in Baltimore's mayoral race and some other races around the country, and that they didn't groom leadership. They had no sustainability plan. They didn't say what the next fight looks like after we integrate, after we get the first black elected, whatever, whatever. And that lack of forward thinking and vision on both of their parts, from a fiscal point and from a sustainability point, is bringing them both to the same place now and making it very, very hard, because it's generational now that it's been said to fix in time for Super Tuesday or any other major election coming up in the next, I'd say, 4 to 6 years.
Lenny, welcome back. Glad you could get back to us. We were just talking, someone had just called in just about how the unions are so disconnected from their members, how they've ended their master's program in labor relations, how they're not representing unions, pulling people out, educating people anymore. And we're just saying how the I think that, you know, from the Republican perspective, you're seeing surges as well on both sides here from people who are just saying that they're sick of the establishment not answering the questions.
And they are. You're seeing that on both sides, and I think that's what's fueling a lot of the frustration. The problem is, if you're voting in people that are less inclined to create solutions, then it's more rhetoric either way. Whether it's loud rhetoric being yelled on the floors of the Congress or Senate, or if it's if it's simply something that's being yelled at a rally, it doesn't matter because things are not getting to a point of solution. And I think people are now focusing more on wanting to be heard than wanting to have problems solved. And that's problematic because now we're just venting. We're not resolving.
Let me go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. And John, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes. I read an article in Salon recently talking about neoliberal identity politics leading up to the Clinton campaign. How you basically have, the black vote we saw in South Carolina and other places, where they're playing them almost like the old Democratic solid South white vote, where they're just appealing to racial things. And economically, they're basically just pursuing neoliberal policies.
So what does that say to you?
Me?
Yeah, to John, the caller. John, you there?
Yes.
So I said, what does that say to you?
Well, I mean, I'm for Bernie Sanders. And it's like basically we're missing an opportunity for white and black working people to get together by just harping on race and racial issues. They're important, but we're really missing an opportunity here. And I feel like Hillary Clinton is basically playing people.
John, it's interesting, and I think Catalina Bosco is not here, but let me turn this to you, and Lenny, please jump in as well. I think that the difference here is, that, I mean, what's also happening here is that exposes the depth of the dynamic in America between race and class, because I think this, the Sanders campaign is interesting to study in that way, that they are raising some of the most important class issues in that kind of politics that has been raised in a long time in a national campaign. Maybe since Jesse Jackson in a very serious way. Well, the other side is that people are saying, but what people are not understanding, the it is the depth of race and racism in America and how that divides us. And we're seeing that, I think, played out in the confusion side of Sanders' campaign. And you saw that played out, I think, in the South Carolina vote.
I think the confusion comes in that Barack Obama was running about classism and we shaped the conversation. And there's an unhealthy marriage between media and politics, especially as sensationalism has taken over in a 24-hour news cycle. But there were elements of President Obama's campaign that spoke directly to classism, and we missed it. And then we framed the context of being a post-racial America because we had elected our first black president when that wasn't the conversation. The conversation should have been while we're making room on the field in terms of the fight of racism. Classism is still being ignored. And he couldn't say those things verbatim in the way that Bernie Sanders is in that particular climate. But that's where the confusion lies. The confusion lies is that we didn't understand really what the message of hope and change was that he was running on. It wasn't just hope and change. And I think you alluded to it about the non-union and the union workers that voted for him in 2008-2012. They heard it because, similar to the way that black people were listening to Barack Obama to hear our issues addressed, the same thing is that a lot of the issues that affect the black community affect poor white communities too. And without saying that, the language was there and they were listening to it and they were listening for it and they heard it and identified and recognized themselves in that dynamic in a way that my community unfortunately didn't. And so now Bernie Sanders is again carrying on that baton, and they're not hearing or listening for where they fall into his campaign communication and messaging, though they are very much in line with everything that the president ran on that we believed in and will have positive impacts and outcomes for us.
So, Len, let me ask you this question. This is a little bit of a turn. Then I'll go back to the phones. Judy, you're the next caller up at 410-319-8888. But when Trump was asked a question about David Duke and the Klan, and then hedged and stuttered and bumbled and said, "I don't know much about David Duke," which is kind of hard to believe, and then wouldn't repudiate the Klan. I was thinking back to somebody tweeted in about A little while ago, a motivated voter tweeted in, Reagan was told the KKK endorsed him for re-election in 1984, and his response, in comparison to Trump's, and he put his response on the Twitter, but was you know, that he just dismissed, we will not deal with these racists, they can't come in our campaign, basically what he was saying. But then now you've seen Trump kind of backpedaling today, saying there's something wrong with his earpiece, and he didn't hear it right. which was a bit absurd. So what are your thoughts about that, and what's going on inside the Republican Party around this? Lenny, you there? Do we have Lenny? Folks, cross class? Lenny? Huh. Okay, see if we can...
Do we have Lenny back?
I think so.
I was just going to say, I think that it's really telling that I watched that video a couple of times, and it's like he knew that he was stuck and he couldn't find a way that answers the question, that doesn't turn off the people who he's been energizing. But it's impossible for you not to have any clue at all about the Ku Klux Klan or need to do research and still say that you want to be the president and not know a group that has been such an important part of our history here in this country, and where we've come from and where we're going. It was really just facetious to me, and I think it was a deer in the headlights moment of, I don't want to say that I disavow these people, and I would rather pretend I don't know them, but at the same token, it's kind of difficult when your father has been arrested, and it's impossible that you have no idea who the Ku Klux Klan is to be able to give answer.
Or who David Duke is.
Or who David Duke is. I mean, well, even if we went with the Trump celebrity kind of reality show brand of intelligence, right, which is not that much intelligence, I can see him saying he doesn't know who David Duke is and even trying to pivot into a joke like and say something about the Duke that has it. But to then, after being pushed on it some more by Jack Tapper, to say that you don't know the group and have to research the group, I think that was even more of a telling point for me than his pretending that he doesn't know who David Duke is.
410-319-8880. I'll bring another thought about this in a moment. Judy, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I just want to say that I think a lot of people out in the regular world are kind of jaded. After Barack Obama came into office with so much hope and enthusiasm, to watch him seemingly capitulate or give in to having to constantly, what do you call it, compromise with the Republicans, even when he had the Democratic majority in both houses of Congress,
yep.
I think has turned off a lot of people who are then looking at, why should I come out and vote? I think a lot of people feel that the candidates have already been chosen. And in discussions with some friends of mine, they were saying, if it's Hillary, how would you get her into office? Well, first you'd have to put her up against somebody who's pretty incendiary, because a lot of Democrats aren't enthusiastic about her, and a lot of Republicans straight up hate her. So if you put in a Trump, and then you can out Trump on something crazy, because he's done a lot of crazy stuff, then who's the only logical candidate left in the general election? It's Hillary Clinton. And if she has been, quote, promised by the elite that it is her turn, which is what she kept saying before, you get the feeling that the election has already been the determination of who the presidency will go to has been created. But now how do we orchestrate the general public to vote and create the optics that look like she got put into office? So I just wanted to share one of those sort of out there perspectives, but it's been discussed.
No, Judy, I think I really appreciate what you just said. I think that there's a lot of wisdom in it. I think that, I mean, the people have kind of went after a bit when I kind of said the same things about Barack Obama. I mean, I think that, you know, his campaign to me was very emotional, both the first time he ran as the first African-American running for president, watching his family could be in the White House. That was just a moment that engulfed us all. And then kind of emotionally saying, you're not going to let right-wing racists kind of push that family out of the White House. All that was real. The other and the hope he gave when he first ran, but all of that kind of went asunder in many ways when he didn't do what you just said, which was the when he had the power in the Senate and the House, could have really pushed back against the banks, could have really made some really huge inroads in other policy matters, and didn't. And in part, that's one of the reasons I think that the Democrats lost the House and the later Senate, was because of that not really pushing, when people really wanted him to push. And I think people got turned off in many ways, Catalina, to politics. And I think that that trend's continuing. You're seeing it in the lack of voters coming out in the primary in the Democrats and the surge in the anti-establishment Republicans, who are, I think, in many ways are motivated by race as well.
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree. And I still don't fault the president as much as I do the House while they had a Democratic majority, because they felt like, the way I read it is that they felt like they used all their political capital to get him there, and then they didn't want to extend anymore and risk losing their seat. And so being afraid to act is what ultimately did them in, more so than what he didn't push on. Because to think back, when he was first elected and the things that he had been elected on and the things he had been elected about, the CBC was not overly supportive of the president. They were not calling for people. They were not doing things to engage their respective bases around the country going into the midterms. They backed away from the more radical side of the things that we had elected the president for and went back into that establishment messaging. And that's ultimately what did it. And what Judy said is a very real thing. I don't think it's a conspiracy theory at all. I think it would be orchestrated to make Hillary Clinton look like it's her turn. But that idea of turns, we're watching it play out to a degree right now between Van Hollen and Edwards in the Senate race. This notion of there being turns is the one that's been failing the Democratic Party.
Did you say term? T-E-R-M?
Turn. T-U-R-N.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You run, and this particular base has the power, you know. For many years, that seat has been held by Senator Mikulski. So it's been the rhetoric that it was the other side of 295's turn to have a senator from Maryland on Capitol Hill. And this notion of turns and it being somebody else's heir apparent is something I see more so on the Democratic side than the Republican side. You hear a lot of people say it wasn't Rubio's turn. He skipped ahead. He jumped Bush. But he's been elected to office since 2000. And who's to say when your turn is, if you are old enough and you have the residency requirement and it is legal, because of the Constitution, for you to run? And that notion of keeping younger generations at bay until you feel like you've accomplished your bucket list is another thing that's feeding apathy and is destroying parties, more specifically on the Democratic side than you really see on the Republican side.
That's an interesting analysis, Kat. I may come back to that, what you just said, but let me try to get another caller in here, 410-319-8888, because we agree and disagree on what you just said, but I think it was really good analysis. 410-319-8888. Chris, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Mark. Hi, Catalina.
Good morning.
Hi. it was a caller, I believe, just now, and she said Hillary Clinton being the next viral thing because Cruz is crazy and Trump is good. You know what? First of all, I'm a black guy. Let me say this. Hillary Clinton is a liar. She's on a federal investigation right now during the campaign. Bernie Sanders is way too old to become a president, and he won't because he's a socialist. He's an admitted socialist. He's not going to become the president. We've got to get used to one of those other two candidates, which is Trump or Cruz.
Mm-mm.
Right? So then you weigh the lesser of two evils, right? Now, Cruz is not going to get any support from anybody in his own party because he went against his own party's rules. Remember a couple of months back, shutting the government down and stuff like that. And his own party wants an outsider being Donald Trump. The only thing, the only beef they have with this guy is his mouth is a little like off the chain. All they're asking from Trump is to be have a little more tact, and he'll have all of the support. And then you have the far righters who, if they have nobody else to vote on, they're gonna vote for Trump anyway. People should get used to a Republican in the office coming up. And if black people vote for Hillary Clinton and fall victim to Democratic bamboozlement one more time, I might leave the country. I mean, I'm tired of black people being so led by the Democrats, and then you have to stop and look at where we're at. What are they doing? We still messed up.
So, Catalina, let's go back. Chris, I appreciate it, because you said the similar things sometimes, Catalina, but I mean, I would challenge, Chris, what you're saying You know, because we always talk about this Democratic-Republican paradigm as if that's if Democrats aren't doing the job, then we should turn to Republicans. And I think that the idea, to me, at any rate, of hearing and listening to the possibility of a Rubio, Cruz, or Trump presidency is a pretty scary scenario for the future of America. Not that I'm, you know, wild about the idea that Hillary being the candidate for the Democrats, but I think that that America finds itself between a rock and a hard place. But I think Catalina, just in terms of, you know, when you look at the Republican leader of analysis, I'm not getting the title right. I apologize. In the House, who's been hired by the Republicans to analyze economic development, says that Republican economic policies would mean that a 50% cut in what the federal government spends, 50% across the board. And people are not wrestling with that fact. I want to bring that up in a later conversation. So, I mean, I think that it's we get to the point of getting – if we don't get beyond the emotions of this campaign, America is in serious trouble. I'm thinking about – we've only got a couple of minutes left. But let me just – there's this one quote from W.E.B. Du Bois that really struck me this morning in my reading. He said, either the United States will destroy ignorance or ignorance will destroy the United States.
Absolutely. You know, back when JFK was elected, that was when, at least for my mom, who I learned, you know, I learned politics from my parents and at home. What I learned and watching has been true for all of my life is that people vote either from their emotions or the economics. They vote for a person that they like the most and they believe the most and therefore trust, or they believe is going to change their financial situation and bring them closer to the American dream. And we've relied on that for so long, and that's been the conventional wisdom for so long, and how campaign messaging is done on a professional nature, that we did not cultivate a smarter electorate. But I think Rubio's going to be the nominee.
Oh, my God.
And not Trump. And I'm actually okay with that. I think that Clinton has trouble if she becomes a nominee running against Rubio, because this is the first presidential cycle where millennials outnumber baby boomers. And so
yeah, but millennials are not going to vote for Rubio. I'm sorry. Just because he's young, they're not going to vote for Rubio.
I really think they were, and that's why he's doing better in this GOP primary than they anticipated, and why he's coming in second to Trump and not third, and he's beating Clinton.
Republican millennials will vote for him, but the 80% of the millennials in America will not vote for him. Oh, but tell me, we got to wrap up. We'll pick that up on another day, Kat.
Okay.
All right. Catalina Berth, thanks so much for sticking with us. Appreciate it.
No problem. No, appreciate you.
Thank you all for joining us and writing in and calling in and making the show what it is. I hope you enjoyed the programs today. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andre Melton. Our interns are Sienna Greaves, Manifa Wilson, Calvin Perry, and Morgan Barber, who is with us today. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. Podcast The Mark Steiner Show, share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org, or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz, I mean, for your source for the home of 2016 mayoral debate, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.